he is going to be examined. Before him is a draped table. He must make a dissection. Although he is only a student here, he hasn't been taught, he doesn't know how. The room is empty, but he knows he's being watched by those who are there to judge him. It's a woman under the sheet. He can tell by the contours. He hopes she isn't too old, as that would be somehow worse. A poor woman, dead of some unknown disease. No one knows where they get the cadavers, or no one knows for certain. Dug up in the graveyard by moonlight, goes the student joke. No, not by moonlight, you fool, by the resurrection men. Step by step, he approaches the table. Does he have his instruments ready? Yes. Here is the candlestick. But he has no shoes on, and his feet are wet. He must lift off the sheet, then lift off her skin, whoever she is or was, layer by layer. Strip back her rubbery flesh. Peel her open. Gut her like a haddock. He's shaking with terror. She will be cold, inflexible. They keep them on ice. But under the sheet, there's another sheet. And under that, another one. It looks like a white muslin curtain. Then there's a black veil, and then, can it be? A petticoat. The woman must be down there somewhere. Frantically, he rummages. But no, the last sheet is a bed sheet, and there's nothing under it but a bed. That and the form of someone who's been lying here. It's still warm. He is failing desperately, failing his examination, and so publicly, too. But now he doesn't mind that. It's as if he's been reprieved. It will be all right now. He will be taken care of. Outside the door, which is the same one he came in by, there's the green lawn, with a stream flowing beyond it. The sound of the running water is very soothing. There's a quick, indrawn breath and the smell of strawberries, and a hand touches his shoulder. He wakes, or dreams he wakes. He knows he must still be asleep because Grace Marks is bending over him in the close darkness, her loosened hair brushing his face. He isn't surprised, nor does he ask how she has managed to come here from her prison cell. He pulls her down. She is wearing only a nightdress. And falls on top of her, and shoves himself into her with a groan of lust and no manners, for in dreams everything is permitted. His spine jerks him like a hooked fish, then releases him. He gasps for air. Only then does he realize he's not dreaming, or not dreaming the woman. She's really here, in the flesh. Lying motionless beside him in the suddenly too quiet bed, arms at her sides like an effigy. But she is not Grace Marks. Impossible now to mistake her boniness, her bird's rib cage, her smell of singed linen and camphor and violets, the opium taste of her mouth. It's his thin landlady, whose first name he doesn't even know. When he entered her, she made no sound either of protest or delight. Is she even breathing? Tentatively, he kisses her again. Then again, small kisses. It's the alternative to taking her pulse. He works his way around until he finds a vein, the one in her neck, throbbing. Her skin is warm, a little sticky like syrup. The hairs behind her ears smell of beeswax. Not dead, then. Oh, no, he thinks. What next? What have I done? Dr. Jordan has gone off to Toronto. I don't know how long he will be gone. I hope it's not very long, as I have become quite used to him somehow, and fear that when he goes away, as he's bound to do sooner or later, there will be a sad emptiness in my heart. What should I tell him when he comes back? He will want to know about the arrest and the trial and what was said. Some of it is all jumbled in my mind, but I could pick out this or that for him, some bits of whole cloth, you might say, as when you go through the rag bag looking for something that will do to supply a touch of color. I could say this. Well, sir, they arrested me first, and James next. He was still asleep in his bed, and the first thing he did when they woke him up was to try to blame it on Nancy. If you find Nancy, you will know all about it, he said. It was her fault. I thought this was very stupid of him, as although she hadn't yet been discovered, they were bound to ferret her out sooner or later, if only by the smell, and indeed they did so, the very next day. James was trying to pretend he didn't know where she was, or even that she was dead, but he should have held his tongue about her. It was still the early morning when they arrested us. They hustled us out of the Lewiston Tavern at great speed. I believe they were afraid the men there might stop them and attract a mob and rescue us, as they might have done if McDermott had thought to shout out that he was a revolutionary or a Republican or some such, and he had his rights and down with the British, because there were still considerable high feelings then on the side of Mr. William Lyon Mackenzie and the rebellion, and there were those in the States that wanted to invade Canada. And the men that arrested us had no real authority. But McDermott was too cowed to protest, or else he lacked the presence of mind. And when they'd got us as far as the customs and said we were wanted on suspicion of murder, then our party was allowed to proceed and to set sail without further ado. I was very glum going back across the lake, although the weather was fair and the waves not large. But I cheered myself up by telling myself that justice would not let me be hanged for something I hadn't done, and I would only have to tell the story as it happened, or as much of it as I could remember. And as for McDermott's chances, I did not rate them very high. But he was still denying all, and saying we only had Mr. Kinnear's things with us because Nancy had refused to pay us what we were owed, and so we had paid ourselves. He said if anyone had killed Kinnear, it was most likely a tramp, and there had been a suspicious-looking man hanging around who'd said he was a peddler and sold him some shirts, and they should be looking for that one, and not an honest man like himself whose only crime was to wish to better his lot in life through hard work and immigration. He certainly could lie, but never very well, and he wasn't believed and might just as well have kept his mouth shut. And I thought it wrong in him, sir, that he was trying to put the murder off on my old friend Jeremiah, who'd never done any such thing in his life that I knew of. They put us into the jail in Toronto, locked up in cells like animals in a cage, but not so close together that we could speak. And then they examined us separately. They asked me a good many questions, and I was quite frightened, and not at all sure what I should say. I had no lawyer at this time, as Mr. Mackenzie only came into it much later. I asked for my box, which they made such a fuss over in the newspapers, and sneered at me for referring to it as mine, and for having no clothes of my own to speak of. But although it was true this box and the clothes in it had once been Nancy's, they were hers no longer, as the dead have no use for such things. They held it against me as well that I was at first calm and in good spirits, with full and clear eyes, which they took for callousness. But if I'd been weeping and crying, they would have said it showed my guilt, for they'd already decided I was guilty, and once people make up their minds that you have done a crime, then anything you do is taken as proof of it. And I don't think I could have scratched myself or wiped my nose without it being written up in the newspapers and a malicious comment made on it in high-sounding phrases. And it was at this time that they called me McDermott's paramour, and also his accomplice. And they wrote also that I must have helped to strangle Nancy, as it would take two to do the job. The newspaper journalists like to believe the worst. They can sell more papers that way, as one of them told me himself, for even upstanding and respectable people dearly love to read ill of others. The next thing, sir, was the inquest, which was held very soon after we were brought back. It was to determine how Nancy and Mr. Kinnear had died, whether by accident or murder. And for that I had to be examined in court. By now I was thoroughly terrified, as I could see that feeling was running very much against me. And the jailers in Toronto made cruel jokes when they brought in my food, and said they hoped when they hanged me that the scaffold would be high, as that way they would get a good look at my ankles. And one of them tried to take advantages, and said I might as well enjoy it while I had the chance, as where I was going I'd never have no fine, brisk lover like himself between my knees. But I told him to keep his filthy self to himself. And it would have come to worse, except that his fellow jailer came along and said that I hadn't been tried yet, much less condemned, and if the first one valued his position he should keep away from me. Which he did, mostly. I will tell Dr. Jordan about this, as he likes to hear about such things, and always writes them down. Well, sir, I will continue. The day of the inquest came, and I took care to appear neat and tidy, for I knew how much appearances count as when you are applying for a new position, and they always look at your wrists and cuffs to see if you are of clean habits, and they did say in the newspapers that I was decently dressed. The inquest was held in the city hall, with a number of magistrates present, all staring and frowning, and an immense crowd of spectators and pressmen pushing and shoving and jostling, so as to be in a better position to see and hear. And these had to be reprimanded several times for disruption. I didn't see how they could get any more people into the room, which was stuffed to bursting, but more and more kept trying to thrust themselves forward. I tried to control my trembling, and to face what was to come with as much courage as I could lay hold of, which by that time, to tell you the truth, sir, was not very much. McDermott was there, looking as surly as ever, which was the first time I had seen him since we were arrested. The newspapers said he showed sullen doggedness and reckless defiance, which was their way of putting it, I suppose. But it was nothing different from the way he always looked at the breakfast table. Then they started in to question me about the murders, and I was at a loss. For as you know, sir, I could not rightly remember the events of that terrible day, and did not feel I had been present at them at all, and had lain unconscious for several parts of it. But I was well aware that if I said this, I would be laughed to scorn, since Jefferson the butcher testified that he'd seen me and conversed with me, and said I'd told him we would not be needing any fresh meat, which they made a joke of later because of the bodies in the cellar, in a broadsheet poem they were hawking about at the time of McDermott's hanging. And I thought it was very coarse and common, and disrespectful of a fellow being's mortal struggle. So I said that the last time I'd seen Nancy was around dinner time, when I looked out of the kitchen door and saw her putting the young ducks in. And after that, McDermott said she'd gone into the house, and I said she was not there, and he told me to mind my own business. Then he said she'd gone over to Mrs. Wright's. I told them I was suspicious, and asked McDermott about her several times when we were traveling to the States, at which he said she was all right. But I did not positively know of her death until she was discovered on the Monday morning. I then told how I heard a shot and saw Mr. Kinnear's body lying on the floor, and how I screamed and rushed about, and how McDermott shot at me, and I fainted and fell down. I did remember that part of it. And indeed they found the ball from the gun in the wood of the summer kitchen door frame, which showed I was not lying. We were bound over for trial, which was not to take place until November, and so I was 3 weary months penned up in the Toronto jail, which was worse than being here in the penitentiary, as I was all by myself in a cell, and people coming on the pretense of some errand or other, but really to gawk and gape. And I was in a very miserable state. Outside, the seasons changed, but all I knew of it was the difference in the light that shone through the small barred window, which was too high on the wall for me to see out of it, and the air that would come in, bringing the scents and odors of all I was missing. In August there was the smell of fresh-mown hay, and then the smell of grapes and peaches ripening, and in September the apples, and in October the fallen leaves and the first cold foretaste of snow. There was nothing for me to do except sit in my cell and worry about what was going to happen, and whether, indeed, I would be hanged, as the jailers told me every day. And I must say they enjoyed every word of death and disaster that came out of their mouths. I don't know whether you have noticed it, sir, but there are some that take pleasure in the distress of a fellow mortal, and most especially if they think that fellow mortal has committed a sin which adds an extra relish. But which among us has not sinned, as the Bible tells us? I would be ashamed of myself to take such delight in the sufferings of others. In October they gave me a lawyer, which was Mr. Mackenzie. He was not very handsome, and had a nose like a bottle. I thought he was very young and untried, as this was his first case, and sometimes his manner was a little too familiar for my taste, as he appeared to wish to be shut up in the cell with me alone, and offered to comfort me with frequent pattings of the hand. But I was glad to have anyone at all, to plead my case and to put things in as good a light as possible. So I said nothing about it and did my best to smile and behave gratefully. He wanted me to tell my story in what he called a coherent way, but would often accuse me of wandering and become annoyed with me, and at last he said that the right thing was not to tell the story as I truly remembered it, which nobody could be expected to make any sense of, but to tell a story that would hang together and that had some chance of being believed. I was to leave out the parts I could not remember, and especially to leave out the fact that I could not remember them. And I should say what must have happened, according to plausibility, rather than what I myself could actually recall. So that is what I attempted to do. I was by myself a great deal, and spent many a long hour dwelling on my future ordeal. And if I came to be hanged, what it would be like, and how long and lonely the road of death might be, that I could well be forced to travel along, and what awaited me at the other end of it. I prayed to God but got no answer, and I consoled myself by reflecting that this silence of his was just another of his mysterious ways. I tried to think over all of the things I'd done wrong so I could repent of them, such as choosing the second best sheet for my mother and not staying awake when Mary Whitney was dying. And when I myself came to be buried, it might not be in a sheet at all, but cut up into pieces and bits and fragments, as they say the doctors did to you if you were hanged. And that was my worst fear. Then I attempted to cheer myself up by recalling earlier scenes. I remembered Mary Whitney, and how she'd had her marriage and her farmhouse planned out, with the curtains chosen and all, and how it came to nothing, and how she died in agony. And then the last day of October came round, and I remembered the night we'd peeled the apples, and how she'd said I would cross the water 3 times, and then get married to a man whose name began with a J. All of that seemed now like a childish game, and I no longer had any belief in it. "Oh, Mary," I would say, "how I long to be back in our little cold bedroom at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's, with a cracked wash-basin and the one chair, instead of here in this dark cell, in danger of my life." And it did seem to me at times that a little comfort came back to me in return, and once I heard her laughing. But you often imagine things when you are alone so much. It was at this time that the red peonies first began growing. The last time I saw Dr. Jordan, he asked if I recalled Mrs. Susanna Moody when she'd come to visit the penitentiary. That would have been about 7 years ago, shortly before they put me into the lunatic asylum. I said that I did recall her. He asked me what I thought of her, and I said she looked like a beetle. "A beetle?" said Dr. Jordan. I saw that I had astonished him. "Yes, a beetle, sir. Round and fat and dressed in black, and a quick and scuttling sort of walk, and black shiny eyes, too. I do not mean it as an insult, sir," I added, for he'd given one of his short laughs. "It was just the way she looked, in my opinion." "And do you remember the time she visited you, just a short time after that, in the provincial asylum?" "Not well, sir," I said, "but we had many visitors there." "She described you as shrieking and running about. You were confined on the violent ward." "That may be, sir," I said. "I do not recall behaving in a violent manner towards others unless they did so first to me." "And singing, I believe," said he. "I enjoy singing," I said shortly, for I was not pleased by this line of questioning. "A good hymn tune or ballad is uplifting to the spirits. Did you tell Kenneth Mackenzie that you could see the eyes of Nancy Montgomery following you around?" he said. "I have read what Mrs. Moody wrote down about that, sir," I said. "I don't like to call anyone a liar, but Mr. Mackenzie put a misconstruction upon what I told him."
"And what was that?"
"I said red spots at first, sir, and that was true. They looked like red spots."
"And after?" And after, when he pressed me for an explanation, I told him what I thought they were. But I did not say eyes.
Yes, go on, said Dr. Jordan, who was trying to appear calm. He was leaning forward as if waiting for some great secret, but it was no great secret. I would have told him earlier if he'd asked me.
I did not say eyes, sir. I said peonies.
But Mr. Mackenzie was always more fond of listening to his own voice than to someone else's. And I suppose it's more the usual thing to have eyes following you around.
It is more what is required, under the circumstances, if you follow me, sir.
And I guess that was why Mr. Mackenzie misheard it, and why Mrs. Moody wrote it down. They wanted to have things done properly.
But they were peonies, all the same, red ones.
There is no mistake possible.
I see, said Dr. Jordan,
but he looked as puzzled as ever.
Next he will want to know about the trial. It began on the 3rd of November, and so many people crushed into the courthouse that the floor gave way. When I was put into the dock at first I had to stand, but then they brought me a chair. The air was very close, and there was a constant buzzing of voices, like a swarm of bees. Different people got up, some in my favor, some to say I'd never been in trouble before and was a hard worker and of good character, and others spoke against me, and there were more of these. I looked around for Jeremiah the peddler, but he was not there. He at least would have understood something of my plight and would have tried to help me out of it, for he'd said there was a kinship between us, or so I believed. Then they brought in Jamie Walsh. I was hoping for some token of sympathy from him, but he gave me a stare filled with such reproach and sorrowful anger that I saw how it was with him. He felt betrayed in love, because I had gone off with McDermott. And from being an angel in his eyes and fit to be idolized and worshipped, I was transformed into a demon, and he would do all in his power to destroy me. With that my heart sank within me, for of everyone I knew at Richmond Hill I had been counting on him to say a good word for me, and he looked so young and fresh and unspoiled and innocent that a pang went through me, for I valued his good opinion of me, and it was a grief to lose it. He got up to testify and was sworn in, and the way he took the oath on the Bible, very solemn, but with hard rage in his voice, did not bode me any good. He told about our party the night before, and playing the flute, and how McDermott had refused to dance, and walked him part way home, and how Nancy was alive when he'd left us, and on her way upstairs to bed. And then he told how he'd come over the next afternoon, and seen McDermott with a double-barrel gun in his hand, which he claimed he'd been using to shoot birds. He said, I was standing by the pump with my hands folded, wearing white cotton stockings, and when asked where Nancy was, I laughed in a teasing manner and said he was always wanting to know things, but that Nancy had gone to the Wrights, where there was someone ill, with a man who'd come to fetch her. I remember none of this, sir. But Jamie Walsh gave his testimony in a straightforward manner which was difficult to doubt. But then his emotions overcame him, and he pointed at me and said, "She has got on Nancy's dress. The ribbons under her bonnet are also Nancy's, and the tippet she has on, and also the parasol in her hand." At that there was a great outcry in the courtroom, like the uprush of voices at the judgment day, and I knew I was doomed. When my turn came, I said what Mr. Mackenzie had told me to say, and my head was all in a turmoil trying to remember the right answers. And I was pressed to explain why I hadn't warned Nancy and Mr. Kinnear once I knew James McDermott's intentions. And Mr. Mackenzie said it was for fear of my life, and despite his nose he was very eloquent. He said that I was little more than a child, a poor motherless child, and to all intents and purposes an orphan, cast out upon the world with nobody to teach me any better, and I'd had to work hard for my bread from an early age, and was industry itself. And I was very ignorant and uneducated and illiterate and little better than a half-wit, and very soft and pliable and easily imposed upon. But despite everything he could do, sir, it went against me. The jury found me guilty of murder as an accessory both before and after the fact, and the judge pronounced sentence of death. I'd been made to stand up to hear the sentence, but when he said death, I fainted and fell on the railing made of pointed spikes that was all around the dock, and one of the spikes went into my breast, right next to my heart. I could show him the scar. Simon has taken the morning train for Toronto. He's traveling second class. He's been spending too much money of late and feels the need to economize. He's looking forward to his interview with Kenneth McKenzie. Through it, he may uncover some detail or other, something Grace has failed to mention, either because it might show her in a bad light or because she has genuinely forgotten it. The mind, he reflects, is like a house. Thoughts which the owner no longer wishes to display, or those which arouse painful memories, are thrust out of sight and consigned to attic or cellar. And in forgetting, as in the storage of broken furniture, there is surely an element of will at work. Grace's will is of the negative female variety. She can deny and reject much more easily than she can affirm or accept. Somewhere within herself, he's seen it, if only for a moment, that conscious, even cunning look in the corner of her eye. She knows she's concealing something from him. As she stitches away at her sewing, outwardly calm as a marble Madonna, she is all the while exerting her passive, stubborn strength against him. A prison does not only lock its inmates inside, it keeps all others out. Her strongest prison is of her own construction. Some days he would like to slap her. The temptation is almost overwhelming, but then she would have trapped him. Then she would have a reason for resisting him. She would turn on him that gaze of a wounded doe which all women keep in store for such occasions. She would cry. Yet he doesn't feel she dislikes their conversations. On the contrary, she appears to welcome them and even enjoy them, much as one enjoys a game of any sort when one is winning, he tells himself grimly. The emotion she expresses most openly towards him is subdued gratitude. He's coming to hate the gratitude of women. It is like being fawned on by rabbits, or like being covered with syrup. You can't get it off. It slows you down and puts you at a disadvantage. Every time some woman is grateful to him, he feels like taking a cold bath. Their gratitude isn't real. What they really mean by it is that he should be grateful to them. Secretly, they despise him. He recalls with embarrassment and a kind of shriveling self-loathing the puppyish condescension he used to display when paying out his money to some pitiful shop-worn street girl, the beseeching look in her eyes, and how large and rich and compassionate he felt himself to be, as if the favors about to be conferred were his, not hers. What contempt they all must have kept hidden under their thanks and smiles. The whistle shouts. Gray smoke blows past the window. To the left, across flat fields, is the flat lake, dimpled like hammered pewter. Here and there is a log shanty, a line of washing flapping, a fat mother no doubt cursing the smoke, a clutch of staring children. Freshly cut trees, then old stumps, a smoldering bonfire. The occasional bigger house, red brick or white clapboard. The engine pounds like an iron heart. The train moves relentlessly westward. Away from Kingston. Away from Mrs. Humphrey, Rachel, as he has now been entreated to call her. The more miles he is able to put between himself and Rachel Humphrey, the lighter and less troubled in spirit he feels. He's gotten himself in too deep with her. He's floundering. Images of quicksand come to mind, but he can't see how to extricate himself, not yet. Having a mistress, for that's what she's become, he supposes, and it hasn't taken long, is worse than having a wife. The responsibilities involved are weightier and more muddled. The first time was an accident. He was ambushed in his sleep. Nature took advantage of him, creeping up on him as he lay entranced without his daytime armor. his own dreams turned against him. This is the very thing Rachel claims of herself. She was sleepwalking, she says. She thought she was outdoors in the sunlight, gathering flowers, but somehow she found herself in his room, in the darkness, in his arms, and already then it was too late. She was lost. Lost is a word she uses a lot. She has always been of a sensitive nature, she's told him, and subject to somnambulism even as a child. They used to have to lock her into her room at night to prevent her wandering around in the moonlight. He doesn't for an instant believe this story, but for a refined woman of her class, he supposes it's a way of saving face. What was really in her mind at the time, and what she is thinking now, he scarcely dares to guess. Almost every night since, she's come to his room in her nightdress, with a white ruffled peignoir thrown over it. The ribbons at the throat untied, the buttons open. She carries a single candle. She looks young in the dusk. Her green eyes gleam, her long, fair hair is down around her shoulders like a shining veil. Or, if he stays out late, walking by the river in the cool of night, as he's increasingly inclined to do, she'll be there waiting for him when he returns. His initial reaction is one of ennui. There is a ritual dance to be gone through, and it is one that bores him. The encounter begins with tears, quivering, and reluctance. She sobs, she reproaches herself. She pictures herself as ruined, wallowing in shame, a soul condemned. She's never been anybody's mistress before. She has never stooped so low, indulged in such abasement. If her husband discovers them, what will become of her? It is always the woman who's blamed. Simon lets her go on in this vein for a time, then he comforts her, and assures her in the vaguest of terms that all will be well, and says he doesn't think any the less of her for what she has so inadvertently done. Then he adds that nobody need know, provided they are discreet. They must take great care never to betray themselves by word or glance in front of others, especially Dora, because Rachel must know how servants gossip, a caution that isn't only for her protection, but for his. He can imagine what Reverend Verringer would have to say, among others. She cries more at the thought of discovery. She writhes with humiliation. He doesn't think she's been taking the laudanum anymore, or at least not so much. Otherwise, she wouldn't get so worked up. Her behavior would not be so reprehensible if she were a widow, she goes on. If the major were dead, she would not be betraying her marriage vows, but as it is, he tells her the major has treated her abominably, and is a cad, a scoundrel, a dog, and deserves even worse from her. He has kept a semblance of caution. He's made no offers of instant marriage, should the major suddenly and accidentally topple off a cliff and break his neck. Inwardly, he wishes him a long and healthy life. He dries her eyes with her own handkerchief, always a clean one, freshly ironed, smelling of violets, tucked conveniently into her sleeve. She winds her arms around him, presses close, and he feels her breasts pushing against him, her hips, the full length of her body. She has an astonishingly tiny waist. Her mouth grazes his neck. Then she draws back, aghast at herself, with a gesture of nymph-like coyness, and bends away from him in an attitude of flight. But by this time he is no longer bored. Rachel is unlike any woman he's ever had before. To begin with, she's a respectable woman, his first. And respectability in a woman, as he's now discovered, complicates things considerably. Respectable women are by nature sexually cold, without the perverse lusts and neurasthenic longings that drive their degenerate sisters into prostitution, or so goes the scientific theory. His own explorations have suggested to him that prostitutes are motivated less by depravity than by poverty. But nevertheless, they must appear as their clients wish to imagine them. A whore must feign desire and then pleasure, whether she feels them or not. Such pretenses are what she's paid for. A cheap whore is cheap not because she's old or ugly, but because she's a bad actress. With Rachel, however, things are reversed. Her pretense is a pretense of aversion. It's her part to display resistance, his to overcome it. She wishes to be seduced, overwhelmed, taken against her will. At the moment of her climax, which she attempts to disguise as pain, she always says no. In addition, she implies, by her shrinking and clinging, her abject imploring, that she's offering him her body as a kind of payment, something she owes him in return for the money he spent on her behalf, as in some overdone melodrama featuring evil bankers and virtuous but penniless maidens. Her other game is that she is trapped, at the mercy of his will, as in the obscene novels obtainable at the seedier bookstalls of Paris, with their mustache-twirling sultans and cowering slave girls, silvery draperies, chained ankles, breasts like melons, eyes of gazelles, that such configurations are banal does not rob them of their power. What idiocies has he uttered in the course of these nightly debauches? He can hardly remember. Words of passion and burning love, of how he cannot resist her, which, strange to say, he himself actually believes at the time. During the day, Rachel is a burden, an encumbrance, and he wishes to be rid of her. But at night, she's an altogether different person, and so is he. He, too, says no when he means yes. He means more. He means further. He means deeper. He would like to make an incision in her, just a small one, so he can taste her blood, which in the shadowy darkness of the bedroom seems to him like a normal wish to have. He's driven by what feels like uncontrollable desire. But apart from that, apart from himself, at these times, as the sheets toss like waves and he tumbles and wallows and gasps, another part of himself stands with folded arms, fully clothed, merely curious, merely observing. How far exactly will he go? How far in? The train pulls into the station at Toronto, and Simon attempts to put such thoughts behind him. At the station, he hires a gig and directs the driver to his chosen hotel, not the best one. He doesn't want to squander money unnecessarily, but not a hovel either, as he has no wish to be bitten by fleas and robbed. As they move through the streets, hot and dusty, crowded with vehicles of all descriptions, lumbering wagons, coaches, private carriages. He looks around him with interest. Everything is new and brisk, bustling and bright, vulgar and complacent, with a smell of fresh money and fresh paint about it. Fortunes have been made here in a very short time, with more in the making. There are the usual shops and commercial buildings, and a surprising number of banks. None of the eating establishments looks at all promising. The people on the sidewalks appear prosperous enough for the most part, without the hordes of destitute beggars, the swarms of rickety, dirty children, and the platoons of draggled or showy prostitutes that disfigure so many European cities. Yet, such is his perversity that he would rather be in London or Paris. There he would be anonymous and would have no responsibilities, no ties, no connections. He would be able to lose himself completely. 12. Solomon's Temple. I looked at her in astonishment. Good God, thought I, can this be a woman? A pretty, soft-looking woman, too, and a mere girl. What a heart she must have! I felt equally tempted to tell her that she was a devil, and that I would have nothing more to do with such a horrible piece of business. But she looked so handsome that somehow or other I yielded to the temptation. James McDermott. To Kenneth Mackenzie, as retold by Susanna Moody. Life in the Clearings, 1853. For it is the fate of a woman, long to be patient and silent, to wait like a ghost that is speechless, till some questioning voice dissolves the spell of its silence. Hence is the inner life of so many suffering women, sunless and silent and deep, like subterranean rivers, running through caverns of darkness. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. The Courtship of Miles Standish, 1858. The law offices of Bradley, Porter, and Mackenzie are located in a new and somewhat pretentious red brick building on King Street West. In the outer office, a lank youth with colorless hair sits at a high desk, scrabbling with a steel-nibbed pen. When Simon enters, he jumps up, scattering ink drops like a dog shaking itself. "Mr. Mackenzie is expecting you, sir," he says. He places a reverent parenthesis around the word Mackenzie. "How young he is," thinks Simon. "This must be his first position." He ushers Simon along a carpeted passageway and knocks at a thick oak door. Kenneth Mackenzie is in his inner sanctuary. He's framed himself with polished bookshelves, expensively bound professional volumes, three paintings of racehorses. On his desk is an inkstand of Byzantine convolution and splendor. He himself isn't quite what Simon has been expecting. No heroic delivering Perseus. No Red Cross Knight. He's a short, pear-shaped man, narrow shoulders, a comfortable little belly swelling under his tartan vest, with a pocked and tuberous nose, and behind his silver spectacles, two small but observant eyes. He rises from his chair, hand outstretched, smiling. He has two long front teeth, like a beaver's. Simon tries to imagine what he must have looked like 16 years ago when he was a young man, younger than Simon is now, but fails in the attempt. Kenneth Mackenzie must have looked middle-aged even as a 5-year-old. This is the man, then, who once saved the life of Grace Marks, against considerable odds. Cold evidence, outraged public opinion, and her own confused and implausible testimony. Simon is curious to find out exactly how he managed it. "Dr. Jordan, a pleasure." "It is kind of you to spare me the time," says Simon. "Not at all. I have Reverend Verringer's letter. He speaks very highly of you, and has told me something of your proceedings. I am glad to be of help in the interests of science, and as you have heard, I am sure, we lawyers always welcome a chance to show off. But before we get down to it..." A decanter is produced. Cigars. The sherry is excellent. Mr. Mackenzie does himself well. "You are no relation to the famous rebel?" Simon asks, by way of beginning. "None at all. Though I would almost rather claim kin than not. It isn't the disadvantage now that it once was, and the old boy has long since been pardoned, and is seen as the father of reforms. But feeling ran high against him in those days. That alone could have put the noose around Grace Mark's neck."
"How so?" says Simon.
"If you've read back over the newspapers, you'll have noticed that those which supported Mr. Mackenzie and his cause were the only ones to say a good word for Grace. The others were all for hanging her, and William Lyon Mackenzie as well, and anyone else thought to harbor Republican sentiments."
"But surely there was no connection?"
"None whatsoever. There is never any need for a connection in such matters. Mr. Kinnear was a Tory gentleman, and William Lyon Mackenzie took the part of the poor Scots and Irish, and the emigrant settlers generally, birds of a feather, was what they thought. I sweated blood at the trial, I can tell you. It was my first case, you know, my very first. I'd just been called to the bar. I knew it would be the making or the breaking of me, and as things turned out, it did give me quite a leg up."
"How did you come to take the case?" asks Simon.
"My dear man, I was handed it. It was a hot potato. No one else wanted it. The firm took it pro bono. Neither of the accused had any money, of course, and as I was the youngest, it ended up with me. And at the last minute, too, with scarcely a month to prepare. 'Well, my lad,' said old Bradley, 'here it is. Everyone knows you'll lose, because there's no doubt as to their guilt. But it will be the style in which you lose that will count. There is graceless losing, and there is elegant losing. Let us see you lose as elegantly as possible. We will all be cheering you on.' The old boy thought he was doing me a favor, and perhaps he was at that.
You acted for both of them, I believe, says Simon.
Yes. That was wrong, in retrospect, as their interests proved to be in conflict. There were a lot of things about the trial that were wrong, but the practice of jurisprudence was much laxer then.
Mackenzie frowns at his cigar, which has gone out. It strikes Simon that the poor fellow doesn't really enjoy smoking, but feels he ought to do it because it goes with the racehorse pictures.
So you've met our Lady of the Silences?
Mackenzie asks. Is that what you call her?
Yes, I've been spending a good deal of time with her, trying to determine
whether she is innocent.
Whether she is insane, or was, at the time of the murders, which I suppose would be innocence of a kind.
Good luck to you, says Mackenzie. It was a thing I could never be satisfied about, myself.
She purports to have no memory of the murders, or at least of the Montgomery woman's.
My dear man, says Mackenzie, you'd be amazed how common such lapses of memory are amongst the criminal element. Very few of them can remember having done anything wrong at all. They will bash a man half to death and cut him to ribbons and then claim they only gave him a little tap with the end of a bottle. Forgetting, in such cases, is a good deal more convenient than remembering.
Grace's amnesia seems genuine enough, says Simon, or so I have come to believe in the light of my previous clinical experience. On the other hand, although she can't seem to remember the murder, she has a minute recollection of the details surrounding it, every item of laundry she ever washed, for instance, and such things as the boat race that preceded her own flight across the lake. She even remembers the names of the boats.
How did you check her facts? In the newspapers, I suppose, says Mackenzie. Has it occurred to you that she may have derived her corroborative details from the same source? Criminals will read about themselves endlessly if given the chance. They are as vain in that way as authors. When McDermott asserted that Grace helped him in his strangling escapade, he may well have got the idea from the Kingston Chronicle and Gazette, which proposed it as fact, even before there was an inquest.
The knot around the dead woman's neck, they said, obviously required two persons to tie it. A piece of rubbish. You can't tell from such a knot whether it was tied by one person or two, or 20, for that matter. Of course, I made hash of this notion at the trial.
Now you have turned around and are pleading the other side of the case, says Simon.
One must always keep both sides in one's head. It is the only way to anticipate the moves of one's opponent. Not that mine had a very hard job of work in this case. But I did what I could. A man can but do his best, as Walter Scott has remarked somewhere. The courtroom was crowded as hell, and, despite the November weather, just as hot. And the air was foul. Nevertheless, I cross-examined some of the witnesses for over 3 hours. I must say it took stamina. But I was a younger man then.
You began by disallowing the arrest itself, as I recall.
Yes. Well, Marks and McDermott were seized on American soil and without a warrant. I made a fine speech about the violation of international frontiers and habeas corpus and the like, but Chief Justice Robinson was having none of it. I then attempted to show that Mr. Kinnear was something of a black sheep and lax in his morals, which was undoubtedly true. He was a hypochondriac as well. Neither of these things had much to do with the fact that he'd been murdered, but I did my utmost, especially with the morals, and it's a fact that those four people kept popping in and out of one another's beds like a French farce, so it was hard to keep it straight who was sleeping where. I then proceeded to destroy the reputation of the unfortunate Montgomery woman. I didn't feel guilty about slandering her, as the poor creature was already well out of it. She'd had a child previously, you know, which died, I presume, of midwife's mercy. And at the autopsy it was found she was pregnant. Undoubtedly the father was Kinnear.
But I did my level best to produce a shadowy Romeo who'd strangled the poor woman out of jealousy, however pull as I might. That rabbit refused to come out of the hat.
Possibly because there was no rabbit, says Simon.
Quite right. My next trick was an attempted sleight of hand with the shirts. Who was wearing which shirt, when, and why? McDermott had been caught in one of Kinnear's shirts. What then?
I established the fact that Nancy had been in the habit of selling her employer's cast-off garments to the servants, with or without her master's permission, so McDermott could have come by his shirt of Nessus, honestly enough. Unfortunately, Kinnear's corpse had churlishly slipped on one of McDermott's shirts, which was a stumbling block indeed. I tried my best to avoid it, but the prosecution hammered me with it, fair and square.
I then pointed the finger of suspicion at the peddler, to whom the bloody shirt thrown behind the door could be traced, as he had tried to palm off the same goods elsewhere. But that was no good either. There was testimony that the peddler had sold that very shirt to McDermott, a whole poker hand of shirts, in fact, and had then been unobliging enough to have vanished into thin air. For some reason he didn't wish to appear at the trial and run the risk of getting his own neck stretched.
Cowardly fellow, says Simon.
Just so, says Mackenzie, laughing. And when it came to Grace, I must say I wasn't given much help. The foolish girl could not be dissuaded from dressing herself up in the murdered woman's finery, an act which was viewed with horror by the press and public. Although, if I'd had my wits about me, I would have advanced that very fact as evidence of an innocent and untroubled conscience, or even better, of lunacy. But I didn't have the cunning to think of it at the time. In addition, Grace had muddied the trail considerably. She'd said at the time of her arrest that she hadn't known where Nancy was. Then at the inquest, she said she suspected Nancy was dead and in the cellar, though she hadn't seen her put there. But at the trial, and in her supposed confession, that little item put out by the Star and a tidy sum they made by it, she claimed to have seen McDermott dragging Nancy by the hair and tossing her down the stairs. She never went so far as to admit to the strangling, however.
But she did admit it to you later, says Simon.
Did she? I don't recall.
In the penitentiary, says Simon. She told you she was haunted by Nancy's bloodshot eyes, or so Mrs. Moody reported you as having said.
Mackenzie gives an uncomfortable wiggle and looks down. Grace was certainly in a troubled state of mind, he says, confused and melancholy.
But the eyes?
Mrs. Moody, for whom I have the greatest regard, says Mackenzie, has a somewhat conventional imagination and a tendency to exaggerate. She put some fine speeches into the mouths of her subjects, which it is highly unlikely they ever made, McDermott having been an unmitigated lout. Even I, who was defending him, found it a stretch to scrape together a few good words for the man, and Grace a near child and uneducated. As for the eyes, what is strongly anticipated by the mind is often supplied by it. You see it every day on the witness stand.
So there were no eyes.
Mackenzie wiggles again. I couldn't swear to the eyes on oath, he says. Grace said nothing exactly that would stand up in court as constituting a confession, although she did say she was sorry that Nancy was dead. But anyone might say that.
Indeed, says Simon. He suspects now that the eyes did not originate with Mrs. Moody, and wonders what other parts of her narrative were due to Mackenzie's own flamboyant tastes as a raconteur. But we also have McDermott's statement made just before he was hanged.
Yes, yes. A scaffold pronouncement always makes it into the newspapers.
Why did he wait so long, I wonder?
Until the very last, he hoped for a commutation, since Grace had been given one. He considered their guilt to be equal and thought the sentences ought to be as well. and he could not accuse her without knotting the noose very firmly around his own neck as he'd need to admit to the axe-play and so forth.
Whereas Grace could accuse him with relative impunity, says Simon.
Just so, says Mackenzie. Nor did she flinch from it when the moment came. Sauf qui peut. That woman has nerves like flint. She'd have made a good lawyer if a man.
But McDermott didn't get his reprieve, says Simon.
Of course not. He was mad to expect it, but furious nonetheless. He considered that, too, to be Grace's fault. In his eyes, she'd cornered the clemency market. And as I read it, he then wanted to be revenged.
Somewhat understandably, says Simon. As I recall, he claimed that Grace came down into the cellar with him and strangled Nancy with her own kerchief.
Well, the kerchief was indeed found. But the rest of it is not hard evidence. The man had already told several different stories and was a notorious liar into the bargain.
Although, says Simon, to turn devil's advocate, just because a man is known to lie, it does not follow that he always does so.
Precisely, says Mackenzie. Well, I see the fascinating Grace has been leading you a merry chase.
Not so merry, says Simon. I must admit I've been baffled. What she says has the ring of truth. Her manner is candid and sincere, and yet I can't shake the suspicion that, in some way I cannot put my finger on, she is lying to me.
Lying, says Mackenzie. A severe term, surely.
Has she been lying to you, you ask?
Let me put it this way. Did Scheherazade lie? Not in her own eyes. Indeed, the stories she told ought never to be subjected to the harsh categories of truth and falsehood. They belong in another realm altogether. Perhaps Grace Marks has merely been telling you what she needs to tell, in order to accomplish the desired end.
Which is? Asks Simon.
To keep the Sultan amused, says Mackenzie. To keep the blow from falling. To forestall your departure and make you stay in the room with her as long as possible.
What on earth would be the point of that? Says Simon. Amusing me won't get her out of prison.
I don't suppose she really expects that, says Mackenzie. But isn't it obvious? The poor creature has fallen in love with you. A single man, more or less young and not ill-favored, appears to one who has long been sequestered and deprived of masculine company. You are doubtless the object of her waking daydreams.
Surely not, says Simon, flushing despite himself. If Grace is in love with him, she has preserved the secret extremely well.
But I say surely so. I have had the very experience myself, or the twin of it, for I had to pass many hours with her in her jail cell in Toronto while she spun out her yarn for me to as great a length as it would go. She was besotted with me, and didn't wish to let me out of her sight. Such melting and languorous glances. A hand placed on hers, and she would have thrown herself into my arms.
Simon is disgusted. What a conceited little troll with his natty vest and bulbous nose. Indeed, he says, trying not to let his anger show.
Ah, yes, says Mackenzie. She thought she was going to be hanged, you know. Fear is a remarkable aphrodisiac. I advise you to try it sometime. We lawyers are so often cast in the role of St. George, at least temporarily. Find a maiden chained to a rock and about to be devoured by a monster. Rescue her, then have her yourself. It's the usual thing with maidens, wouldn't you agree? I won't say I wasn't tempted. She was very young and tender then, though no doubt prison life has hardened her.
Simon coughs to hide his rage. How could he not have noticed that the man had a mouth like a depraved old lecher's? A provincial brothel trotter. A calculating voluptuary. There has never been any suggestion of that, he says, in my case. He's considered the daydreams to be all on his side, but already he's beginning to doubt it.
What has Grace really been thinking about him as she sewed and recounted?
I was very lucky, says Mackenzie, and so, of course, was Grace herself, that the murder of Mr. Kinnear was tried before the other. It was obvious to everyone she couldn't have helped to shoot Kinnear, and for Nancy's murder, indeed for both of them. The evidence was circumstantial only. She was